A estate in Tuscany, family winemakers for centuries. This is his first visit to Champaign-Urbana. Information at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
June 30th is our deadline to raise the funds that we'll need for next year's programming here on WILL Radio. That is next fiscal year. Your support has been terrific, but we're still $105,000 short of our fiscal year-end goal. If you've not made a contribution recently, you can help us out and close that listener support gap. Give us a call at 217-244-9455 or contribute online at our website. It's WILL.UIUC.EDU. And thanks. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, Congress passed a package of laws known collectively as the USA Patriot Act. From the very beginning, the Patriot Act was controversial. People on both the left and right sides of the political spectrum argued that it gave the government too much power to look into the lives of Americans. Now, some provisions of the law, the Patriot Act, are due to expire, to sunset, at the end of this year. And for some time now in Washington, there has been a lot of debate over whether or not that should happen. Continuing concerns about those provisions of the law that are not due to sunset, and also concerns because there are people in Washington who think that the Patriot Act not only should be strengthened, it should be expanded. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to get a sense of what's going on, certainly from the perspective of the civil liberties community, as we talk with Ed Yonka. He is with the Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's the director of communications and has been with us before here on the program to talk about these and other related issues. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone listening certainly can join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, that one, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, those are the numbers. I would like to mention, too, that for people who are here in the area, Champaign-Urbana, interested in this issue and being involved in some more discussion, that our guest will be talking about it on June 15th. That is next Wednesday at 7 in the evening at the Urbana Free Library. So if you're interested, you're certainly welcome to stop by. And again, people who are listening this morning can give us a call. Mr. Yonka, hello.
Hi, David. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Well, it's good to be back with you.
It's kind of the picture here is kind of confusing, as I said, because some parts of the act are due to sunset. But there has been some debate and discussion now, at least for the past couple of months, in Washington about overall what to do with the act. There are some people who believe that parts of it indeed should be allowed to sunset, and they have concerns about other parts that are not. There are people who believe that it should be expanded. Part of this conversation has happened in the Congress behind closed doors, and periodically we have announcements about what members of Congress think should happen. And just in fact, I think just yesterday,
just late yesterday, correct.
A panel of the Senate approved an expansion of FBI's ability to gather information on possible terror suspects. So for me, it's rather confusing and difficult to try to get a handle on where exactly we are now with the Patriot Act. So there is my challenge. You can start us out by talking a little bit about where things stand right now.
And David, I think you've captured this quite appropriately, which is that we are in a place where this all is moving very quickly, and it's very confusing. What we see right now are sort of two competing trends. The first is that there were members of Congress, both Republican and Democrat, who in 2000, when the administration asked for all of these authorities immediately after 9/11, said that they would grant the authorities, but that some of the most controversial parts of it, they wanted to put sunsets on, and they wanted to give a four-year window where at the end of 2005, we would have a real debate and a look at how these powers and authorities were being used, that we would look at whether or not they had infringed upon people's civil liberties, that we'd look at whether or not they'd been abused or whether or not there'd been misuses of the authority and decide whether or not to make those permanent. And that debate really began in the spring of this year. There were hearings that were held in both the Senate and the House Judiciary Committees with people from the administration, supporters of the Patriot Act, people from law enforcement, as well as people from outside who raised questions about these issues and suggested that there needed to be some reforms. And that process has been moving forward, and bipartisan groups in both the House and Senate have come together around some reform measures. Meanwhile, the administration and allies of the administration in Congress have now used both the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees to hold private, closed-door hearings at which they are actually talking about expanding the authority of the Patriot Act and expanding the ability of law enforcement to gather information about people about whom there is no evidence that they've been involved in any criminal activity without so much as a cursory glance from a judge or any sort of judicial approval or oversight at all. And it's really that kind of diminution of checks and balances that we're really the most concerned about.
Okay. Well, maybe for a moment we might talk a little bit about the provisions of the Act that are due to sunset. And there are a number of them, and they seem to fall within particular groupings, if you want to think about it that way, and maybe that way that we can talk about them. There are a number that all deal one way or another with wiretaps.
Or wiretaps or electronic surveillance.
Right.
That's right. A number of the parts of the Patriot Act had to do or had provisions that I think as people describe them broadly, brought electronic surveillance sort of up to the modern communications age. And so many of those provisions are now set to sunset and, in fact, are part of a debate over whether or not they're working, have been effective, and whether or not they need to be modified in any way.
So is there what kind of sentiment is there on Capitol Hill to allow these to sunset? Are there people who are arguing, no, in fact, the law enforcement community needs these things and we need to keep them in place?
The interesting thing is that the one provision about which people are looking right now in that group that are set to sunset is the so-called roving wiretaps. It's Section 206 of the Patriot Act. Essentially what it provides is that law enforcement can get a warrant in any part from any federal judge in any part of the country to conduct electronic surveillance across the country. And there's some question about whether or not that authority is being, misused in some ways in terms of sort of court shopping to find judges who are more willing to give those warrants and to allow those warrants or that surveillance to then take place across the country. But by and large, the other kind of trap and trace and the pen registries and other things that we often hear about in detail with regard to electronic surveillance, there's really not much discussion or debate around fixing the vast majority of that. I think that people, and while we would have some questions about this, by and large, members of Congress seem to have determined that much of that was just sort of updates that encompass the new technologies that we have that allow, for example, for the surveillance email communications through an internet service provider and not forcing government to go to every place where the internet service provider has an office in order to issue a warrant, but allowing them to do one warrant that travels along with the individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, just for a second to talk a little bit more about Section 206 to make mm-hmm. sure that I understand and other people do. I guess that I understand here the difference between what was and now what is with this is that in the past, say, if you wanted to tap a person's phone, you had to say, well, I want to tap this particular phone. What 206 allows you to do is say, I don't care so much about what phone the person is using. I want to put a wiretap on this person. So that no matter where the person goes, what phone they're using, then you can listen to them no matter where they are and what phone they're talking.
That's one element of it, and the other element is this. It used to be if you wanted to tap Bob Jones in Urbana, you had to go to a federal district court judge in Urbana and say, we want to tap Bob Jones' phone. Here are the reasons we want to. Here is the information we have. Now, the advantage of that is that the judge in Urbana knows something of the local conditions and the local, you know, a number of things that might be happening locally, and has some insight as to the validity or the credibility of the information that they're being presented. In this case, Bob Jones in Urbana can be tapped on the basis of an order which may come from a federal judge in Virginia who doesn't have that kind of localized information about, say, groups or organizations or individuals or whether or not certain people are known to be, say, involved in criminal activity or things of that nature.
Something else that I want to make sure that we talk about, another one of the provisions that are due to sunset, and one that perhaps in the popular media, I think, has gotten the most attention, or at least has gotten a lot of attention, is Section 215.
Correct.
The one that's sometimes called the library provisions. That's
right.
The thing that catches people's attention, that it would, at least it was said, that it would give the authorities, law enforcement, the authority to go down, march down to the library and say, look, David Inge, his is a dangerous guy, and I'd like to know what kind of books he's been checking out of the library. Mm-hmm. And that and there are a number of other things associated with it, but perhaps you could talk a little bit about what is encompassed by Section 215.
Right. Section 215 is the broad category that allows the FBI to gather records about an individual. It has, I think, as you indicate, popularly been known as the library and bookstore provision because, frankly, I think this debate was really heightened and really strengthened when librarians across the country realized the impact of Section 215 and raised those concerns. But Section 215 goes much broader. Section 215 actually covers what are called tangible things, and it says that the government can seize tangible things, that is, any record about your health care, about your psychological care, about your employment, about your credit, about your banking, about your home ownership, about your educational records, about any of those things that you've shared with a third party, that they can get those records, and the standard for collecting those records is that they have to assert that they are relevant to an ongoing investigation. There is no requirement that there be any demonstration that if they're seeking, to use our example from before, Bob Jones' records about his psychological care, or Bob Jones' banking records, or Bob Jones' library records, that they can collect all that information, and there does not have to be a single shred of evidence that Bob Jones is involved in any terrorist activity, let alone any credible any criminal activity. They simply have to say to the court, the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in Washington, D.C., that this is relevant to an ongoing investigation. And then that information is collected, and the library, the doctor, the psychiatrist, the therapist, the employer, the bank is gagged from telling Bob Jones or anyone else that this information has been gathered. And so this has really garnered, in many ways, the most criticism and the most attention, because it allows for a kind of a fishing expedition about people and about individuals, and really allows government to gather personal, intimate information without any demonstration that it really does anything to make us safer or to protect us against terrorism.
Mm-hmm. And are there people who are arguing in Congress that Section 215 should be reauthorized, and we should keep it? It should not be allowed to sunset.
Well, this is the one place, and I think probably given what happened in the Intelligence Committee of the Senate yesterday, this is the place where I think we see the widest divergence of views. I think that most members of Congress on both sides of the political aisle have heard the arguments over the last 4 years from the FBI, who suggest that there are times when they need to be able to gather this plethora of information and records and do so in a fairly quick manner, and to do so secretly. And so you've had people who've said, okay, if that's what you want to do, if that's something that is necessary, it's a requirement to keep us safe, then that's fine. But you should have to demonstrate to a judge that there is some individualized suspicion about a person or about an individual, which then leads you to want to collect this information. In other words, that if you're looking for Bob Jones, it's not simply because you say, I think Bob Jones was once attended a mosque with X, Y, or Z, or once attended a club with a person that we're investigating, but that Bob Jones had an ongoing financial relationship or some other kind of relationship with an individual who is under investigation, and so therefore there is an individualized suspicion and reason to investigate Bob Jones. So a number of people on both sides of the aisle have come around supporting a bill called the Security and Freedom Insured Act, or the SAFE Act. These titles for these bills take on sort of crazed proportions in a debate like this. And one of the things that the so-called SAFE Act would do is to say that in order to obtain a Section 215 order and gather this information, the FBI would have to demonstrate that the person about whom they are seeking these records, that there is a very specific reason for which they're gathering that information. Hmm. Now, you juxtapose that, I suppose, against what happened yesterday in the Senate Intelligence Committee, where the Senate Intelligence Committee has now voted out a bill that would expand the authority of Section 215 and remove even the minimal judicial oversight that now exists in the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and say that from now on, the FBI could gather this information just using an administrative subpoena. And so that no one outside of the FBI would ever even look at an order, and it would simply be issued. And so this is the place where I think as we move through this debate over the next 6 weeks, this is the place at which I think the fault line is really going to be drawn.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Ed Yonka. He is Director of Communications for the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois, the Illinois chapter of the ACLU. We're talking about current debate and discussion over the Patriot Act. This package of laws passed by Congress shortly after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. Parts of it are due to sunset at the end of this year. And as he explained, now for some time, there has been debate, discussion on Capitol Hill about just what to do with the Patriot Act. There were some people who think that portions of it went too far, and there are some people both on the right and left of the political spectrum who believe that, and there are people who believe that the act, in fact, was the right thing to do and should be strengthened. We're talking here, and your questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just to stay talking a little bit about Section 215, as you explained, and as we discussed, that this was part of the Patriot Act that got a lot of attention, particularly the library provisions, and particularly because people who were in the library business and library and information sciences were very concerned about it and stood up and said, look, we think this is a problem, and we think this is why. From what we know about how Section 215 has been applied, do we in fact know that it has been used that way?
Well, it's a very interesting question for this reason. When Attorney General Gonzalez testified at the first hearing on this round over the renewal of these provisions of the Patriot Act, one of the points he made, and one of the points he made very specifically in his testimony, was he first said that the FBI had never sought any library records. He then had to amend his testimony to say that they had never sought any library records under Section 215. So one of the issues is there are a host of other authorities under the Patriot Act, including what are called national security letters, which act in much the same way as that administrative subpoena I described earlier, or FBI agents simply showing up at a place, a library or other place, and requesting information. What is clear is that libraries around the country have been approached and have been requested and have had information requested of them. What we don't know is what other records have been sought, because one of the difficulties is that when these gag orders apply to the business or the agency or the individual who receives a Section 215 order, they're actually threatened with penalty of law if they were to reveal that they had even been served with one of these orders. And so we don't know the full scope of it. But I think the 2 points I guess I would underscore is that, number one, we know that the FBI has sought library records, and number two, one of the questions that members of Congress have been asking that the administration has thus far really not given a clear answer to is exactly how many United States citizens have been the subject of record searches using Section 215. And so, you know, one of the things that I think, in addition to the secret hearings in the Intelligence Committee, that one of the other problems with this is that the government won't share even the most basic aggregate information about how they're using this authority, which would allow all of us to, you know, be able to make better judgments about the effectiveness or the use of this authority.
So there, no doubt their argument is, well, this is national security, so we can't tell you that.
And you know what? I think all of us understand that, and I will just say for the record, you know, that I would completely understand the fact that they can't tell me the names of the U.S. citizens whom they have searched under Section 215, but they ought to be able to tell us the number. Mm-hmm. They ought to be able to say, you know, not even in regions, not even in areas, but if the number's 5, if the number's 20, if the number's 200, they ought to be able to tell us how often they've used that authority. One of the things that I think we ought to know when we're talking about making this kind of intrusive authority permanent is just how regularly it's used. You know, I think we were often led to believe during the debate over the original Patriot Act that it was this extraordinary authority that needed to be given in order to investigate and disrupt acts of terrorism. And I think we ought to see just how, at least to be able to get a sense and a shape of how that authority and how often that authority is in fact being used.
I'd like to have you talk particularly about one of the sections of the act that is not due to sunset, but has been very controversial and concerns people, and that's Section 213.
Right.
The so-called sneak and peek provisions, which allows the government to search a person's home, for example, without telling them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could just, again, sort of sketch out what 213 allows the government to do.
Right. Section 213 put into statute a practice that had grown up in a number of jurisdictions around the country and sort of routinized its use. And that is what is technically known as a delayed notification search warrant. And the theory is that there are exigent circumstances where letting someone know that you are searching their home or their business may so disrupt the investigation as to cause the people to flee. You know, for example, if there were a group of people building a bomb in a garage and you conducted a search, they might not return to that garage as a result, and then you wouldn't know who was part of the plot, and they may be able to go on and complete the plot in some other place. That practice had been used for some time in criminal investigations, in the conduct of drug investigations and investigations against organized crime. The Patriot Act created this kind of national system for the investigation of terrorism that allows the FBI to use what we call sneak and peek warrants, and to be able to search a home, to look at information, to even seize property without notifying someone that you have been there and that you've taken you've seized the property and conducted the search. I think we all think about what a search warrant, you know, looks like on the television police shows, you know, where somebody shows up at the door, knocks, says, "I have a warrant to search your home or your business," or et cetera. The problem with Section 213 is really twofold. The first is that it is so broadly written that it essentially creates a catch-all where all that the FBI has to claim is that their investigation might be disrupted in order to get a sneak and peek warrant. And the second thing is that it allows them to seek delay after delay after delay in terms of notification so that ultimately people's homes or businesses could well be searched and there would be no way that they might ever know that their home or business was the subject of that search. So what has what people have proposed, again, accepting the argument of the government that this is a power that you might need in an extraordinary circumstance. And again, under this SAFE Act, which I should say is sponsored in the Senate by Senator Dick Durbin and supported in the House by Congressman Tim Johnson, is a provision that says, number one, that you have to define the real exigency of the circumstance in order to get a sneak and peek warrant, that you have to show why it is that notifying people you've conducted a search of their home is essential. And number two, and do it in secret is essential. And number two, that it sets a specific limit at the end of which you have to notify people that the search has been done. Because one of the things that we saw, for example, under in the use of this provision came in the case of Brandon Mayfield, the Oregon lawyer who was for some time detained and suspected of involvement in the Madrid train bombing, even though he hadn't left the country for more than 3 years prior to the bombing. What happened in his case, he was a convert to Islam who had represented Muslims in the Portland area. There was a mistake about his fingerprint, which showed up on some material that was linked to the Madrid bombing. The FBI agency and the FBI headquarters in Washington knew that there were questions about whether or not it was actually Mayfield's fingerprints. Meanwhile, the FBI office in Portland conducted a series of sneak and peek warrants on his home and his office. He told this incredible story about, you know, he and his family would come home and there would be locks on the door that were locked that they hadn't locked in 5 years, that there were footprints on their carpet that were of such a size and a type that was not like anybody else in the home, and that things were actually missing. They had this series of events that took place over a number of days in which they were, you know, literally thinking that someone was breaking into their home when they weren't there. It turns out it was FBI agents who were doing this, and they were doing so about an issue that people at the headquarters in Washington already knew that Mr. Mayfield really wasn't connected to those events.
Hmm. Again, I guess I'm prompted to ask a question, the same one that I asked about 215. And again, it's probably one that there isn't a ready answer for. But do we know how often these kinds of searches under Section 213 have been carried out?
Actually, on that one, we do know, David, because there is a requirement. These are actually warrants that are issued through the federal courts. And so the Administrative Office of the United States Courts actually tracks them. Here's what we know. In the year 2003, there were more sneak and peek warrants that were issued than traditional search warrants.
Hmm.
So these are being used literally hundreds of times a year all across the country. And again, they're being used, we believe, broadly because they are able to conduct these searches and do so in a way, with the least or the smallest of excuses. And again, people are being allowed to, or I should say that they're being used in a way in which people are often delayed for extended periods of time without knowing. And I should say that this is one of the other things. This is one of the other areas where we believe, based on the reporting of the courts, and some minimal reporting that the Justice Department has done to Congress, that these search warrants, these sneak and peek warrants, are actually being used broadly in a variety of different cases and not simply in cases or matters related to terrorism. And I, you know, suppose that that gets caught up in the whole argument that in the whole discussion that, you know, in many ways we were told that we had to pass these laws because these were the tools that were necessary in order to conduct, you know, a war on terrorism, in order to interdict and stop any Americans from ever being the victims of terrorism again. And it turns out that they're being used in, you know, Medicaid and Medicare fraud cases and other things of that nature.
I have a caller here. Just one quick follow-up. We have talked about the fact that there are some sections, and we talked about some of them, some sections of the Patriot Act that are due to sunset at the end of this year. This section we're talking about, Section 213, is not one of them. But is that at all up for discussion in Washington?
It is, because the Section 213 is one of the sections that's targeted for reform under the SAFE Act. And there, you may remember that a couple of years ago, the House of Representatives actually voted in an appropriations bill to eliminate any funding or to bar any funding to the Justice Department to use in pursuit or to use in executing sneak and peek warrants. That actually is one of those things that, you know, then when there was a conference committee and et cetera, it got removed. But there are a number of people on both sides of the aisle, and I would say across ideologies, who are really looking at this sneak and peek provision in particular and really want to do something during this discussion and this debate to put some limitation on it and to put some specific time frame in terms of the notification.
All right. We have a couple of callers. We'll get right to them. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Ed Yonka. He is Director of Communications for the Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we're talking about the Patriot Act. By the way, if you're interested in being involved in some more discussion of the act, our guest, Ed Yonka, will be in Champaign-Urbana giving a talk, something of an update on the renewal of the Patriot Act on June 15th at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Urbana Free Library. So anybody who is interested in stopping by should feel welcome. And on the program here this morning, calls are welcome to 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Urbana. We will go to them first. They're first in line. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask two questions and then hang up.
Mm-hmm.
First, the federal agents that most people have contact with the most are their local postmen. And I was curious if anything about the Patriot Act was changing our normal relationship with the postmen. Maybe they're being asked to do things they weren't before. And then number two, as to these sneak and peek things, I was curious to know if any information had come to light about how is it that the how are they managing to break in and exit without neighbors noticing what's going on and, you know, giving the information back to the victim. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Let me take those in reverse order. With regards to the sneak and peek and how those are executed, you know, there's actually a long tradition in law enforcement of conducting what we have colloquially called in Chicago for years black bag jobs. The FBI during the 1960s, according to litigation that we did, conducted about 500 such break-ins in the city of Chicago, mostly looking at peace activists and people opposed to the Vietnam War and civil rights leaders. I don't think there's any gloss that one can put on this. They tend to look like break-ins. People disguise themselves as delivery people or other things, and they sneak into people's house and then they exit, you know, in a secret fashion. That is essentially the way that works. In terms of the post office and the relationship with the post office, I'm happy to say that really hasn't changed under the Patriot Act. The caller might remember that the Justice Department had a conversation after 9/11 in which they talked about recruiting people like truck drivers and delivery people and UPS drivers and the postmen to act as kind of agents in neighborhoods, and they were going to train them, and there was a lot of talk about that, and Congress refused to fund the activity and spoke about, I think, in quite direct fashion, the fact that those are people for you know, most of us, that we have a very personal relationship with our postman. You know, it's somebody we see often and we know, and we, you know, sort of welcome into our neighborhoods and things like that. And the post office employees themselves did not want to be in a position where they were seen as being spies in their own communities.
All right, let's go on to another caller here. Next person up is on line number 2 in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. What I wanted to know is, considering the fact that the Patriot Act itself breaks several constitutional amendments, what's being done in the courts to fight this and have the whole act as a whole rendered unconstitutional? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Well, we see a lot of activity in the courts, and one of the things about the act that I think is often sort of often escapes it, and I should have said this up front, and I think you actually did, David, is when you described it as being a series of provisions. The Patriot Act is more than 350 pages of detailed legislative language that actually changes, alters, or amends some 80 existing federal statutes. So in terms of a challenge, there isn't a challenge to the entire act. You have to end up challenging each, you know, the individual provisions. Now, the vast majority of the provisions weren't controversial. They were things like increasing border patrols at the northern border, or providing restitution to families who lost loved ones on 9/11, changing some things about the banking laws with regards to international transactions, things that would not involve a constitutional challenge. There have been, and there are ongoing, challenges to several of these provisions. For example, there was a provision of the Patriot Act which expanded the ability of the FBI to use these so-called national security letters to gain access to information. The ACLU represented an internet service provider that had been served with one of these coercive national security letters, and we were allowed, and ultimately a federal court judge struck down the law as too broad, too vague, and unconstitutional because it violated the Fourth Amendment. A judge in California struck down a provision of the Patriot Act that would hold a person accountable for, quote-unquote, providing material support to a terrorist group, even if the individual didn't know they were actually providing the support to the group, and even if they didn't know that the group was on the terrorist watch list. And then finally, we are actually challenging Section 215 in two different cases across the country as being overly intrusive and violative of Fourth Amendment rights. The problem has been with many of these kinds of challenges that it's difficult to get people to file the challenges and to test the validity of the law because so much of the activities of the federal law enforcement agencies are done in secret that you don't know who it is who's been affected. One of the things that I think was difficult about the challenges that we filed to Section 215 is that because of the gag orders that are part of Section 215 and we talked about earlier, we've literally had to file the case on behalf of people who believe they've been the subject of a Section 215 search, but we can't know for sure because, of course, that's all subject to the gag order.
Hmm. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Ed Yanka. He's Communications Director for the Illinois Chapter of the ACLU. We're talking about the Patriot Act. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask you about another of the provisions that people in the civil liberties community have been concerned about, and this is another one of those things like 213 that is not going to sunset, and it's something that caught my eye, and I don't know if it's of particular concern to you, but I wanted to ask you about it, and that's Section 802, which seems to allow the government a very broad power to define almost anything. Maybe that's going too far, but many different things to define them as terrorism. And apparently there was some concern about whether this could be used to discourage or harass people who were exercising their lawful rights to protest government policy.
David, it is a section which does very much concern us because, candidly, that definition is so broad, it is so wide, that groups, everything from, you know, groups like Greenpeace to Operation Rescue are frankly domestic terrorism groups under the Patriot Act. And again, whether one agrees or disagrees with the political positions, with the actions of those organizations, I think it's difficult to think of them as terrorist groups. As groups which should be investigated or labeled as being terrorists. The problem with the definition that is part of Section 802 is that it says, in effect, that a group is a terrorist organization if they break a federal, state, or local law in order to, or as part of an activity which is designed to coerce or change public or governmental policy, and if that activity is then life-threatening. Now, the problem is, of course, placing yourself in the middle of the street, doing a sit-in in the middle of the street, violates a local ordinance in terms of the law. It could be construed to be life-threatening because, you know, the person who's sitting there could be hit by a car. And if you're doing that, for example, to promote the notion of marriage equality, as actually we've had some people do in the city of Chicago outside the county building, that technically falls within the definition of someone being a terrorist. And those are not the people we should be concerned about. Those are not the groups that we should be concerned about. And I think that, one of the things that's been troubling is that the Justice Department has been very resistant to the notion of changing that definition, which is something that I think is particularly troubling because of, I would say, on a couple of different fronts. The first is that in a recent round of litigation under the Freedom of Information Act that the ACLU engaged in on the national level, we actually got information that the FBI had targeted for surveillance and investigation people who were leading protests at the Democrat and Republican national conventions in 2004. Now, why those people would have, and I should say they were targeted for this investigation and surveillance by the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. Now, why these people would be considered as terrorists simply because they oppose U.S. policy or U.S. foreign policy or domestic policy or want universal health care, why we would divert resources from what are threats to our country and to our people in order to investigate domestic individuals who simply have a disagreement in terms of policy is something that I think most of us probably can't understand. But I think when you look at that history, recent history, of having targeted those people and then the unwillingness to, change this definition in any way is something that's really troubling. I will say the other part of this is that you may remember or your listeners may recall that after 9/11, the state of Illinois passed a state anti-terrorism measure, which in some forms tracked the Patriot Act. When then-Attorney General Jim Ryan first introduced the bill, and his office was a major sponsor, they included the very same definition as was in the Patriot Act. A number of groups, including the ACLU, met with the then-Attorney General and officials in his office and explained our concerns about the definition, and they changed it because they recognized the concern that you didn't want to be putting resources into investigating, monitoring, surveilling, or looking at domestic groups that really weren't a threat when you know there actually is a threat out there from people from the outside. And so, you know, this is a provision that, again, is one of those that is addressed in the so-called SAFE Act that I referenced earlier and is one that I think is very important. Because one of the things the Department of Justice will say, one of the things they'll tell you if you ask them about this is, well, you know, that's just the definition, but of course there's no criminal penalty which is attached to that definition. But the Department of Justice has tried to get a criminal definition attached to it. They tried in the so-called Patriot Act II that Congress ultimately did not move. They have tried in other times in other bills to actually get criminal penalties attached to this definition of domestic terrorism. And I think it's something that, you know, we ought to all be concerned about because when we give over this kind of unchecked authority to government to investigate our lives, and we do, when we give them the thinnest of pretext to do it, you know, the problem is that we know who will be investigated. It will be people who have views that are divergent from the current administration, who object to foreign policy or domestic policy that the government is pushing, and that's one of those kind of dark days, I think, from the 1950s and the 1960s that most of us have hoped that we would never return to.
We have about 5 minutes left. We have another caller here. I want to try to get in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. This is a very important program, and I'm glad you're having it, and we need a lot of people participation here. I have a sore throat, so I'm not going to stay on very long, but this really is important, about, and I'm not trying to denigrate anything that the fellow is saying, but I would like to say to the guest that, you know, it would be much easier for people to follow your lead if other parts of your organization weren't so busy in other parts of the country trying to separate the Christian roots of this country the way it's doing.
Well, let me say two things. First of all, I think in terms of the caller's suggestion about participation, I couldn't agree more. I think, frankly, you know, and we've talked about this, especially for those in your audience who are of a college age or a high school age, these literally are the civil liberties issues of your time. The question about how we handle this Patriot Act debate this year, if we're going to make this act permanent, is going to define in many ways the kind of country you're going to live in for the next 30 years. Not only a country that you come to maturity in, but frankly the kind of country that you begin to raise your children in. And, you know, for the rest of us, I think it really calls into question the entire relationship that we're going to have with our government and whether or not we're going to have to think about Big Brother. In terms of the other comment about our organization and the other work that we do, I would just say while I respect the caller's views, you know, we have a mission of protecting the Constitution and enforcing the Constitution wherever we see it violated around the country. That sometimes brings us into conflict with people. But I think that you know, one of the interesting things has been around this issue that we have found ourselves quite candidly to be in league with people with whom we disagree so often on many of these other issues. I often joke, you know, one of the people who is working the hardest against renewal of the Patriot Act is former Congressman Bob Barr from Georgia. I hope I won't reveal too much about my own political leanings. I can't find the other issue on which Bob Barr and I agree. But this is one that I think people are working together across a number of different ideological and political lines. And I think they're doing it because, frankly, the Constitution doesn't have a political party and it doesn't have an ideology. It's an American document and it's something that we all believe in.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make. And perhaps, again, as this discussion goes forward, we can have some other people on the program with different kinds of perspectives on the issue. But the fact of the matter remains that while one of the important organizations that has been leading this, at least representing concerns about the Patriot Act, is the ACLU. People think of it as being a liberal organization, but there are certainly a number of people, and you mentioned one of them, with very, very solid conservative credentials who are also have also outlined some of the very same concerns. So this is not necessarily, in fact, is not an issue that it's just all about liberals and liberal concerns.
Yeah, I think, as I said, you know, and I just think it bears repeating. You know, we think of our mission as protecting the Constitution, but we don't think of it as our Constitution. People who disagree with us on other fundamental issues believe just as strongly in the Constitution. And when you see, you know, I heard Senator Durbin recently tell a joke that he is sponsoring the SAFE bill in the Senate with Senator Larry Craig from Idaho, a very conservative Republican member. And one of the other senators who's the co-sponsor said at the press conference where they announced it, he joked that he thought that either Durbin or Craig had not read the bill if both of them were sponsoring it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I do want to, however, mention one more time that our guest, Ed Yonka, from the Illinois chapter of the ACLU, will be in Champaign-Urbana next week on June 15th. He'll be giving a talk at the Urbana Free Library, 7 in the evening, on the Patriot Act. So people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you're interested in finding out more, being a part of that conversation, you certainly should feel free to stop by. And, of course, the ACLU does have a website, and there's a lot of information on the Patriot Act there. So you can go to www.aclu.org, and you can find out what their thinking is and get more information, and that way learn more about it. And, Mr. Young, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thank you so much for having me on.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. We're going to take a break. When we continue with Focus 580, we'll be talking with Ken Ackerman about his new biography of Boss Tweed. That in a little bit. We'll also have news from National Public Radio first, though, an update on the markets.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-217-217.